Good morning. Welcome to the UU Fellowship. My name is Kathy Hedge, and I'm a member of this fellowship. And all of you are welcome here. Those of you who were born in the light of fairness and justice, you are welcome here. And those who have suffered at the hands of others for who you are or whom you love, you are welcomed here. Those of you who yearn to correct the errors of our past and to celebrate our steps to a positive future, you are welcome here. Please take a moment to say hello and welcome your neighbors. Thank you. What a lot of smiles I see when I look out there. That's terrific. Well, I would like to share with you who we are. We are a fellowship of Unitarian Universalists who meet to express our individual beliefs and religious convictions. We belong to the national organization, the Unitarian Universalist Association of Congregations. We have no creed, no prophet, or sacred book, but we agree on seven principles that are listed on the back of your program. And if you didn't get a program, they're handed out at the front over here. And visitors, you are invited to join us after our service for coffee and conversation. And if you are new, because I did see some new faces, if you are new to the fellowship, or if you have a guest and you'd like to introduce yourself, you are welcome to do so. But please wait for the microphone. So if you'd like to introduce yourself, you can just raise your hand and we'll bring the mic to you, or you can stay peacefully silent. Okay. Well, thank you. Now it's the time for our announcements, and we do have several. First of all, there are announcements that are in our bulletin, so please attend to those. We also would like that you sign our tapestry, which I don't know if it is laying in another place in the building today, but if you haven't had a chance to sign, these are not the ones we sign. We have ones with leaves on them that have our names. So, also, Enel Forrester asked me to announced that Koinana, I don't think I pronounced that right, the pecan sales, she's going to put in pecan sales. She's going to turn those into tomorrow, and she has the catalogs here. Enel, would you like to raise your hand? She's right there in the back. These things are delicious, and the group was the originator of Habitat for Humanity, and she is going to be ordering tomorrow. If you'd like those pecans, please see Enel. Also, we have presents today. Pat Ambers brought in a huge stack of her old music that she's getting rid of, and there's some real classics. I mean, some of those are 100 years old. So a lot of piano music and songs, so... the choir invaded at first, so we may have taken some of the goodies, but there's plenty there for everyone. Also, when we do our chalice lighting today, we are going to be using a piece from the book at the back of our hymnal, and that is number 662, and I'll announce that again before we do that section. That will be for the chalice lighting. And then a note from our presenters today that today, oh, not yet, hon, not yet, thank you. Today we're going to, you can blow it out. Yes, blow it out. Thank you. All right, today we're going to tackle a difficult subject. It's the subject of race and racism in World War II. Mark has stated that this is a large, huge topic that we could not do justice to in the short time we have. So we're going to focus on two main themes: racism and propaganda against the Japanese. The racism and bias against African Americans, race relations with the African American community, and finally some of their accomplishments during the war. Mark says that he hopes that you will learn, which you know that we will, but that you'll be able to do some research when we talk after we're done with our talk today, and we hope to have discussion time at the end. Okay, so now it is time for our chalice lighting. If you would please open your books, the hymnals, to number 662, and if you would please read the responses at the end, or I'm sorry, the parts in italics. Number 662, and this is called Strange and Foolish Walls. The years of all of us are short, our lives precarious. Our days and nights go hurrying on, and there is scarcely time to do the little we might. Yet we find time for bitterness, for petty treason and evasion. What can we do to stretch our hearts enough to love their littleness? Here we are, all of us, all upon this planet, bound together in a common destiny, living our lives between the briefness of the daylight and the dark. Kindred in this, each lighted by the same precariousness, flickering flame of light, how does it happen that we are not kindred in all things else? How strange and foolish are these walls of separation that divide us. So we do hope that with our lighting, that we can use these moments of togetherness to heal the separations in our world. Would you join us now for our opening hymn, which is number 162, Gonna Lay Down My Sword and Shield. And if you were sleepy when you came in, this will take care of it. Hymn number 162.
Thank you.
Thank you. That was lovely. And now is the moment that we take to share our joys and concerns, all the things that have happened to us recently that we would like our fellowship to join in, either those good or sad. Please wait for the microphone. Thank you, because I know we have some good announcements today.
Hi, Molly McGoy. I don't know if she'll thank me or not. Where's Amy? Oh, Amy Fowler will be graduating next week from Kansas State, and I'm sure we'll hear more about it after she walks next weekend. But working mother, commute, you know, everything you want to put into it. So I think that's worthy of celebration.
Ann March, and I just wanted to share my joy at being a part of this group that has so many talented and energetic and people with vision that are willing to work hard. I wanted to point out the new banners that Harriet got the inspiration to do and then donated all the materials, took it to the RE, and had the kids cut out snowflakes, the wrong season. And, you know, some of the coffee ladies cut out snowflakes, and then we put those all together. And we're just lucky to have Harriet with all her enthusiasm and all the other people in the group that I don't work with, that I don't see, that I know work hard all the time to make this such a great place. So thank you.
Hi, Chris Bailey. Everybody, it's not an emergency or anything, nothing to worry about, but Larry Weaver, my dad, is under the weather. That's why he's not here today, and if you could be thinking about him, think healthy thoughts. I think it's just a bad cold that he can't shake.
I have a joy that me and my mom and my brother, Arthur, he's probably in the nursery, I think. I don't know where he is. He can be anywhere at once. Well, I'm glad that we actually were able to make plenty of cookies, in fact, for all of you. 248.
Oh, yay!
My name is Jake, and I won my age group at the science fair.
Thank you for sharing and for those the ideas that are left in your heart. We are with you in spirit. And now is the time for a story for all ages, and I get to do it today, which makes me very happy. So, young people, would you please join me up front? Oh, boy, oh, boy. Well, we have a very serious topic today that we're going to be talking about with the adults, and I know that it's something that you might want to talk about with your family when we're done here today. And I know that you're intelligent enough to understand things that are happening in our world, and our topic today definitely has to do with that whole issue of fairness. And so what I'd like to know first is if someone asked you, what does it mean to be fair, what would you answer?
Taking turns. Giving a fair share of cleaning at your house.
Anyone else has something they want to share about what they think is fair? Think about something you know is not fair, and then what's the opposite of that?
Letting someone else play with your favorite toy.
not judging people by how they look.
Sharing toys.
Very good. Any other thoughts you'd like to share?
Sharing if you have a favorite necklace or a piece of jewelry that's actually hard to make, like if you made it, sharing it with someone else and letting you use those materials.
Thank you very much. So we have a very kind group here. My personal favorite definition of fair is not everyone getting the same thing, but everyone getting what he or she needs. And I think that's important. And what we're going to be talking about today is a time which often still continues when things aren't fair. And I have a story I would like to read to you. This is real. This was a letter that was written 70 years ago. And before I read it to you, I want to, in the sanctuary today, we're going to be talking about a specific period of unfairness. And this was during and after World War II, a time when many countries were at war. It was a huge, that's why they called it a world war, because there were so many. You have a question?
It's actually a comment. It's kind of like, it wasn't fair for the people who came to America because they wanted to have their own way of life and not follow the King of England's rules.
So they had a revolution, didn't they? Yeah. Well, to this letter that I'm going to read to you today, as I said, is an example of unfairness. And it was written during the time of World War II. But I would like you to think about what the writer said and ask yourself, was that fair? But before we begin, though, I want to explain two things, and that's during war, when soldiers from the other side are captured. When soldiers from the other side are captured, they are considered prisoners of war, and they actually are put in prisons. And so that's important when he talks about prisoners of war. It's soldiers from the other side that were captured and then brought back to the country and held in prison until after the war was over. The other thing that I want you to know is that this letter was written by a black American soldier, and he called himself a Negro. And that was a respectful word. There's not any problem with that word. And it was written 70 years ago in 1944. And it's taken from a book by Stephen E. Ambrose called Citizen Soldiers. So I'm going to read you. And again, this is a real letter, okay? And think about if it was fair. Okay. Did I have your attention? Thank you. All right. In April 1944, Corporate Rupert Timingham wrote Yank Magazine. "Here is a question that each Negro soldier is asking," he began. "What is the Negro soldier fighting for? On whose team are we playing?" He recounted the difficulties that he and eight other black soldiers had while they were traveling through the South, where old Jim Crow rules. Jim Crow was where they kept blacks and whites separated by law. And this was, he had been traveling through the South for a new assignment. "We could not purchase a cup of coffee," Tillingham noted. Finally, the lunchroom manager at a Texas railroad depot said that the black GIs could go around the back to the kitchen and stand outside for a sandwich and coffee. And as they did, about two dozen German prisoners of war with two American guards came into the station. They entered the lunchroom. They sat at the tables and had their meals served. They talked and smoked. In fact, had quite a swell time. I stood on the outside looking on, and I could not help but ask myself, why are they treated better than we are? Why are we pushed around like cattle? If we are fighting for the same thing, if we are to die for our country, then why does the government allow such things to go on? Some of the boys are saying that you will not print this letter. I'm saying that you will." So the big question is, do you understand what was happening here? Do you understand? Okay. Do you understand what happened? That even prisoners were able to go into the restaurant and eat lunch, but men, because their faces were dark, were not allowed to come inside. They had to be served outside in the back door. Just because. And they were fighting. They were soldiers fighting. So the question is, was this fair? What do you think could have been done at that time? What do you think could have been done?
I think something that could have been done that someone, anyone really, could invite them in. Or at least let them go inside and be served.
I think that they should just know that whites are no better than blacks. We're all the same.
Anyone else has something they'd like to add? Okay. Do you know it took 20 years before in the areas that had the Jim Crow laws? It was against the law. If they had gone inside, they could have been arrested and put in jail. For another 20 years it took before people came and sat, before African Americans sat at a lunch counter. And even then, people were extremely angry and glaring and fighting, and it took a long, long time. So our topic today is they're going to be talking about what happened to those soldiers who were fighting and dying and still not allowed to go inside a restaurant, like you said, was the right thing to do. And so with those thoughts, we'd like to send you on your way. And thank you for listening. Now is the time for our offertory.
Like that one. There. Okay. Thanks. Sorry. good morning. Today I'm going to talk about a couple of subjects that are connected through two main themes, World War II and racism. And Kathy's already a hard act to follow. That was a perfect letter that you read. So, and we're going to get to that subject more in a little while. First, I'd like to take care of a couple things, get them out of the way. The first thing is to answer the question of why we're discussing this and why we're discussing it now. I'm in hopes that you'll be able to gain an understanding of what the institutionalized racism against the Japanese really was during and after the war, and also see that racism changed, excuse me, as circumstances changed. When we begin talking about African-American experiences before, during, and after the war, I hope you'll get a little bit more insight into what's dominating the headlines now and a bit more history behind their grievances. And second, what are my credentials? Why am I up here talking about this? Well, I've read extensively about World War II for all of my adult life. In fact, I remember sitting with my dad when I was probably 7 or 8 watching documentaries about World War II. So I've been doing it a few years. Let's see, seven. So about 30 years then, if I did my math right. or so. During that time, I've mostly concerned myself with greater strategies, researching those, and a few key battles. But I'd never considered racism in World War II. Until about 12 years ago, when I became aware of the subject, or more aware of it, I guess. And in addition, I started reading about the Japanese in the Burma campaign. Burma's sitting next to India. It's called Myanmar now. And how the Japanese fought to the last man there, almost to the last man, which is quite incredible. And it didn't really make much sense why they would do that. This was kind of early on in the war, by the way. And so in looking at that and looking at how the United States interpreted their actions, not just in Burma, but that was the one I was most interested in at the time, I started gaining more and more interest in racism and propaganda, which, again, we'll talk about first. In regards to the African-American experiences surrounding the war, in my attempt to understand the current events, I'm drawing from a period in American history that I know fairly well, and that I hope to share with you today. So with those two things out of the way, I'd like to begin with racism against the Japanese during World War II. And let me set the scene of 1940 America just very quickly. We were an isolationist country after World War I. We had had enough. We were going to let the world take care of itself without us. Our armed forces were very small and armed with antiquated and insufficient resources. And we were somewhat of a colonial power, actually. We had Philippines, Hawaii, Alaska. They weren't states yet. Midway, Guam, Samoa, etc. So we're talking about Japan, World War II. So the first thing we'll do is we'll take a look at a map. Now, this is covering a large area of the world, so all the labels are small. But the areas of Japanese conquest by 1942 have that red dotted line surrounding it. So, and Japan is in the top center, roughly. The Aleutians, which are the only U.S. Territories that were actually invaded and occupied by the Japanese for a short amount of time, are up and to the right, so north east of that. By the way, I've actually been there, too, and there's nothing to fight for out there. It's more desolate than you can imagine. Then we come all the way down to Guadalcanal. If you come straight down from the Aleutians, just about dead center, lower, Guadalcanal and the Solomon Islands, and then go over to Burma, which again is next to India on the far left. That is all of the areas that they had conquered by sometime July of 42, so including China, which they'd been in China for quite some time, and Korea. And Indochina, which was what was called Indochina at the time. So anyway, some of those were new conquests, some were old. The Japanese covered their invasions and occupations with a notion of a greater East Asia coast pro-prosperity sphere, which was a fancy name for we're conquering you and we want you to think like us. Most of the part of this world was colonized by Western white governments, including the U.S., Great Britain, France, and the Netherlands. Under the guise of Asia for Asians, which was their the phrase that they coined, the Japanese conquered vast areas of the East, as we've seen, and installed puppet governments to give some legitimacy to their occupations. However, it was soon realized by local populations that they were really there for natural resources and to impose a program of Japanization. Many millions of Asians died as a result caused by the combat during combat phases, the exploitation of native labor, starvation, and disease as a result of these policies. Okay, so that sets the stage of the beginning of World War II as it relates to the Japanese and Pacific theater. And we need to probably take a quick look back to the West's history with Japan, and this is going to be a very quick look back, but I think it sets the stage fairly well. In the 1500s, as Western missionaries and traders began to visit Japan, the Japanese were described as inscrutable and false. Well, that means that they were impossible to understand or interpret, so people would go there and just walk away shaking their heads. Obviously, we know that that's not true, but that was what was told in the 1500s all the way through the 20th century. Their culture and ceremonies were utterly different from any other in the world. And such characterizations of the Japanese and other cultures and their culture continued through the 20th century, little changed except to become more disparaging. They were defined to be very shallow culturally and the phrase that I read that really struck at home was, they were great in small things and small in great things. So this was a worldview, a Western worldview. So as World War II approached, and as the Japanese had been in China for over a decade, Japan's struggle to make military advances in China led people to believe that their military was no better than a Class C nation. So this is in the late 30s and early 40s, before the war started for us anyway, 1941. As Japan continued its pursuit of domination of Asian countries, their military capabilities became under increased scrutiny by others, other nations, and the common perception was them being ineffective fighting force and overwhelmed. So they were considered ineffective. Their air forces were deemed underwhelming at best, both in hardware and pilots. The planes were considered much less advanced than what we had and our allies, and their pilots were known to have defects in their inner ear as well as being myopic, which resulted in a defective sense of balance. So that was determined by people that, were sitting in Kansas potentially. I don't know how you do that. So, and their physical stature contributed to the notion that they were assured of having less effectiveness on the battlefield, right? They're shorter, okay. But that was, that contributed to that notion. These anti-Japanese myths and smug overconfidences proved to put the Allies at a distinct advantage when the attacks by the Japanese occurred at Pearl Harbor, the Philippines, and the Malay Peninsula, essentially simultaneously and with overwhelming success for the Japanese. While bitter fighting and battlefield atrocities happen in both the European and Pacific theaters of war, one of the biggest differences between the main combatants is the German army was not, the German enemy was not not the people, it was the Nazis. That allowed the U.S. population to have a notion of good Germans and good Italians, and which a large percentage of our population had come from, it's immigrated from Western Europe. The Japanese people themselves were our enemies during the war, however. And obviously, they didn't have a Nazi party or anything like that. It was the people that were our enemy. The Western world, and especially Americans, characterized the Japanese in subhuman and non-human ways, in which they were perceived as monkeys, baboons, gorillas, dogs, mice, rats, vipers. Go ahead and go to the next slide. Rats, vipers, rattlesnakes, cockroaches, and other vermin in general. They are also indirectly represented as the Japanese herd, stripping the population of any of its individuality. So this is all coming from government propaganda, the U.S. obviously. Other allies did similar things. One thing I won't touch on today, but you can be assured that the Japanese did many similar things in regards to the Western culture. So without doubt, however, the most common metaphor used to describe the Japanese was the monkey or the ape. If we could just stay on this for a second. This was a political cartoon, and I don't think you can read it, but it's the Japanese is the gorilla, and they had just murdered, executed, I think, some American flyers. And so that's civilization coming in to take care of the gorillas. And that was very mainstream. So and then in the early months of 1942, I'm continuing with this idea of monkeys and apes, the Japanese as being monkeys and apes. In the early months of 1942, rumors spread that they had advanced so quickly down the Malay Peninsula to capture Singapore. You can go ahead and go to the next. Yeah, that's fine. If you know where Singapore is, down the long, below Burma, et cetera. Singapore's at the bottom of that. Sure. I have a pointer. Yep, straight. maybe. Just to the left a little. Right there. Yeah, the Malay Peninsula comes down from there, and then Singapore is at the bottom of that peninsula. Yeah, anyway, you're, yep. Well, sort of. That's all right. Yeah, you're right in the right area. So it's a, they came in and, so anyway, in 1940, late 1941, early 1942, they invaded the peninsula. Then they moved quickly down the peninsula to Singapore. And I, let's see. The rumor spread that they had advanced so quickly because they were swinging from tree to tree. That was actually how they advanced so quickly. The British were protecting Malaysia, the Malay Peninsula, and Singapore, and they knew that the Japanese couldn't defeat them. So we'll get to that here in a second. Military leaders such as Admiral Halsey referred to them as stupid animals. So Admiral Halsey was one of the greatest naval admirals, in the U.S., and very respected man, although he wasn't necessarily the most intelligent in certain aspects. He referred to them as stupid animals, monkey men, and yellow monkeys. And popular magazines of the day got into the act as well. Collier's featured several full-color covers portraying Japanese airmen as apes. The newspaper carried political cartoons depicting Japanese as King Kong-like brutes, carrying bloody knives or as bandaged, bawling apes who had been beaten in battle. And we saw an example of that. The dehumanization of Japanese made the idea of killing them much more palatable. Humans kill animals for food and for game, so killing these inhuman apes or vermin in general was that much easier. But that was the intent, of course. A favorite send-off to soldiers and Marines going off to patrols in the Pacific Theater was good luck and good hunting. Life magazine ran a cover story about how men on patrol looking for snipers explained that, like many of their comrades, they were hunting for Japs just as they used to go after small game in the woods back home. So they had turned them into non-human, and in particular apes. While many Western commentators challenged the dehumanization of the Japanese people, and a large number of these studies were informative and voided biological determinism, so many others preached just as frequently that they were ethnocentric and condescending. Such complacency was turned into astonishment and disbelief when the Japanese sprung their traps in Pearl Harbor, the Philippines, etc., and elsewhere in December 1941. Indeed, General MacArthur expressed disbelief when Japanese planes destroyed his Air Force while sitting on the ground, and said that they must be white mercenaries. They couldn't possibly be Japanese. In fact, throughout the war, when meeting an enemy for the first time especially that showed great technical ability, GIs and generals alike would assume German troops were providing the expertise for the Japanese Army and Navy. So they were not considered good enough to do the things that they did. To further explain how Japanese were inferior to white men, a popular rumor was that the brain of the Japanese was whiter, meaning it wasn't as advanced as the gray matter that the Occidentals, the white people, have in their head, and therefore they relied on emotion and intuition rather than logic and analysis as white people did. Their particularly slow brains would also be overtaxed in learning the difficult native written language, thereby resulting in overly tired individuals. Again, these are determined by people that are sitting here in the United States. Because the attack on Pearl Harbor came so unexpectedly, most Westerners regarded Japan's initiation of the war as an incredible miscalculation of America's pride, its wrath, and its bountiful resources. The attack thus reinforced the existing impressions that the Japanese were unpredictable and irrational. How could they possibly be dumb enough to attack us? Still no thought was to the notion that they had pulled off an amazing military operation, albeit one that would ultimately end in their defeat. They were still considered lesser men at this time in history. 2 months into 1942, Singapore had surrendered to a Japanese force one-third the size of the British force protecting it, as I had mentioned earlier. And by April 1942, a combined U.S.-Filipino army of 78,000 men surrendered to Bataan. And some of you know the story of the Bataan Death March. If you don't, it's an interesting and terrible story. So there's a quote. Suddenly, instead of being treacherous and cunning, the Japanese had become monstrous and inhuman, wrote a chronicle of the fall of Singapore. The Japanese soldier, who had previously been thought of as night blind and to fear supernatural creatures lurking in the jungle, just as suddenly became born jungle and night fighters, and they were coined Super Bogeyman of the Jungle. Actually, that was by a general. Okay, so you notice that they're still not considered human. They're now superhuman. They were sub, now they're superhuman. Let's see. Now, the same race that was considered greatly inferior to whites are being described as sturdy, Spartan, clever, and ingenious, etc. Line 10. The Japanese were making remarkable gains through 1942, and these gains seemed impossible to many. Could this be the work of supermen? Well, to a large degree, the West's own policies helped the Japanese successes come true. We had a Europe-first policy during World War II, meaning that we put more effort on winning in Europe than we did in Japan or in the Pacific theater. And so that gave the Japanese a freer hand to consolidate their gains, which Germany did not have that, was not given that opportunity. We feared a Japanese attack, an invasion on Western United States, so much that the Rose Bowl game was moved to North Carolina, blackouts were enforced all on the West Coast, and barbed wire was stretched from Canada to Mexico. And in fact, women in certain areas of the coastline were given instructions on how to kill a Jap, which is what you see there. So it was a pamphlet ostensibly for how to beat off an attacker, but it was used for this purpose. Ultimately, these fears led to the involuntary relocation and incarceration of Japanese Americans from California, Oregon, Washington, Western Arizona, and Nevada for the duration of the war, and ordered by President Roosevelt in February 1942, executive order, and it was a done deal. So that topic alone could take days of our time. Unfortunately, we don't have days today, so I will mention it. And if you're not familiar with the relocation of Japanese Americans, it's an interesting and, again, terrible story. Okay, so we have seen how the Japanese people have been viewed as non-human, either subhuman or superhuman, but still not human. Simultaneously, experts and specialists from all allied nations began to turn their attention to analyzing the personality of the Japanese. Studies were conducted by academia as well as by government bureaus and military in an attempt to understand the human side of the Japanese. In sharp contrast to popular idioms of the day that we've already discussed, these studies were conducted generally for two reasons. First, for accurate military planning, and second, for long-term policy making in the post-war environment. This research became best known as studies of the national character. A fundamental aspect of this approach is that all humans share a basic humanity. Many scholars that conducted this research emphasized that they in no way supported the notion of biologically engendered superiority or inferior in intellect or character. These studies were promised to be free of what was called scientific racism. If you never heard of that, that's an interesting topic as well, and goes back many, 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 many years. However, when introduced into the larger public, they were at times met with outrage as communist propaganda. Similarly, the work challenged anti-Semitism and black discrimination in the U.S., and so therefore was attacked by members of Congress and the military. Race, they argued, was not a determining factor in behavior. Jumping ahead in this conversation a bit, It was determined that the Japanese people were overall very tolerant as a whole. And so this resulted in two very important recommendations to the military, to the government as a whole. First, that the Allies refrain from attacking the emperor and the imperial institution. And second, that retention of the throne would hasten post-war change in a more peaceful and democratic notion. These, in fact, were good recommendations. So the emperor was allowed to retain control, albeit on a very limited basis, of course, after they capitulated at the end of the war. However, as you might imagine, this approach was considered tantamount to retaining the very linchpin for all the reasons Japan went to war in the first place. But again, it worked. So, unfortunately, while most of these studies were scholarly exercises done with best intentions in mind, many of them reinforced whole series of assumptions that were about the Japanese that were commonplaces of racial thinking. Many experts dealt with Freudian analysis of Japanese people and took those ideas to the extreme, and then began to focus on perceived childlike aspects of the Japanese people. These ideas were backed up by a very simple observation. Oriental adults looked younger than they actually were. So we're still talking about humans, but now we're talking about children in many respects. So we're continuing to evolve our idea of the Japanese as it fits our needs. And when I say our, of course, I'm talking about the Allies. Finally, many studies of this type revolved around the supposition that Japanese were collectively mentally unstable. So yet another wrinkle to it. It is suggested, however, that that they came to this by studying people that actually were unstable. We had a very small, we didn't have many Japanese POWs here. Very few people from the United States or the allied nations had been to Japan, so the ones that we had here may have been sick, wounded during battle, mentally unstable. So to take that small population and apply it to the entire population of Japan was obviously misguided. That is about the end of our discussion with Japan and propaganda and racism with them. But and that was going to be the entire aspect or the entirety of my presentation today, as I had planned it quite some time ago. With current events and with, I think, a little bit of prodding that may or may not have been intentional, I do have a little bit more to say, but this is actually more about the African-American experience before, during, and after the war. Like a stone cast in the water, the race issue made itself felt in ever-widening circles. Attacks on the Japanese enemy carried over to animosity towards other Asians. For the British, this colored problem made colonial rule in India, Burma, Malaya, and Africa suspect at best. And for America, color was a blunt reminder that upheaval in Asia coincided with bitterness, impatience, anger, and militance among blacks at home. Officials in the United States believed that the Japanese and communist agitators were behind Negro demands for equality. Indeed, General Marshall's the big kahuna in the United States, or all allies, I guess, indicated confidentially that he would rather, quote, he would rather handle everything that the Germans, Italians, and Japanese can throw at me than to face the trouble I see at the Negro question. So, and the letter that was read by Kathy, again, adds to this conversation. A massive study of black Americans in 1944 emphasized that they were thoroughly American, and they had a thoroughly American outlook, and that their loyalty was to the United States in the current war. The results of that study also warned that if black grievances remained unredressed after the war, it was difficult to predict how they would react if a new war were to be fought more definitely along colored lines. While some Japanese propaganda did attempt to appeal to non-whites by emphasizing racial discrimination, the real impact of the war on black opinion came from the very nature of the war. The struggle against both Germans and Japanese was accompanied by attacks on master race theories in general and thus cut at the root of white supremacism and discriminatory laws and institutions within the United States. As happened during World War I, blacks migrated north to in hopes of getting employment in industries in the absence of white men, since they were off at war, but were still denied those jobs. By the way, the United States military would only enlist or accept 11% blacks, because there was 11% in the general population. So there was a restriction put on that. And in fact, the Marine Corps and the Army Air Corps would accept none, no blacks. As happened during World War I, okay, so they went up, they attempted to get jobs and training, government training, and they were not allowed to. Instead, they would be drafted into the segregated military for the country that enforced such segregation. And in fact, and I didn't know this, but even blood plasma was segregated along a black-white line. So it doesn't surprise me. It surprised me I didn't know that. Similar to the Japanese, they were called apes by white soldiers and described in military orders as akin to well-meaning but irresponsible children. So there are some very direct parallels between our views of the Japanese and African-Americans at the time. The Japanese attack had a large symbolic meaning for African-Americans, as did their propaganda and continuing military action as they challenged the idea of white omnipotence. Anecdotes and rumors concerning the black response to war assumed an almost folklorish quality. One described an elderly black sharecropper talking to his white boss and murmuring upon leaving, "By the way, Captain, I hear the Japs done declared war on you white folks." Another widely told story concerned a young black man who, upon it being inducted into the army, requested his epitaph read, "Here lies a black man killed fighting a yellow man for the protection of a white man." Faced with little improvement in African Americans' rights and opportunities, A. Philip Randolph, who was president of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, called on black people to unite in their various protests and direct them at the national government. In the coming months, Randolph helped create the March on Washington movement, which soon became the largest mass movement of black Americans at the time. And this is a poster for that organization. President Roosevelt attempted to convince Randolph not to march. At that time, they had said they had about 50,000 people that would show up. But his request fell on deaf ears. And then as the specter of up to 100,000 black marchers coming to Washington became a real threat, Roosevelt signed Executive Order 8802, which stated in part, I do hereby reaffirm the policy of the United States that there shall be no discrimination in the employment of workers in defense industries or government because of race, creed, color, or national origin. This was really the first attempt to integrate the workforce. Sadly, many industries, especially in the South, evaded the clear intent and engaged in only token hiring. The complete story of discrimination and bias against African Americans before, during, and after World War II is obviously outside the scope of today's discussion, as I've said. So maybe we can have a more complete discussion at some other point in time. I think that'd be great. I would participate in that. However, I would like to touch on the military accomplishment and contributions of black servicemen during the war. Most black Americans were drafted, served in mostly service positions. Their accomplishments and contributions are many, despite such roadblocks. And we're lucky enough to have Michael Oldfather, who has a personal story to tell us of such a group of African Americans that contributed greatly to the war effort and military morale both during and after the war.
This is a personal reminiscence about the Leonard DePar Infantry Chorus. Sometime around 1951, I was about 11 years old. My mother and I used our family's two-season tickets to the Beatrice, Nebraska Community Concert Series to hear the Leonard DePar Infantry Chorus. About 20 black World War II veterans, dressed in white Eisenhower jackets and matching slacks, stole my heart. They were simply magnificent. I made up my mind then and there to sing in a men's chorus just as soon and as often as possible. My first opportunity occurred a little later when, at age 15, after my voice changed and my dream of becoming a bass was realized, I was invited to join the Beatrice Lions Club chorus. Standing beside my dad at rehearsals and performances in the bass section was a wonderful experience. I've had a few other opportunities to sing in men's choruses, but none that matched that very first time. Several decades later, on a day when I probably had a project I didn't want to do, I decided to find out what had become of Leonard DeParr and his infantry chorus. Born in 1914 in Summit, New Jersey, DeParr earned degrees in music from Juilliard and Columbia University. In 1942, he enlisted in the Army. After completing basic training, he entered Officers' Candidate School, and he served as an officer until he left the Army in 1946. During the war, he first organized singing groups on bases in the United States. Then he and his singers moved to the South Pacific, where they entertained in mess halls, hospitals, and often not far from front lines, wherever they could find groups of troops that large and small who wanted a little taste of home. After the war's end, they were stationed in Europe, performing for Allied soldiers and civilians engaged in reconstruction efforts. DeParr estimated that he had led more than 2,000 concerts as a soldier. After several years of touring with the infantry chorus and leading a wide range of musical performances, DeParr was hired by the Lincoln Center for the Performing Arts in New York City, where he served in a variety of musical and administrative roles. His last position there before retirement was Director of Community Relations. He died just before his 84th birthday in 1998. Epilogue. A couple days after the concert that Mother and I attended, we learned that both local hotels, neither of which had been designated so much as a fraction of a star, refused to accommodate these great musicians, these World War II veterans, because of the color of their skin. Instead, they slept on cots in the YMCA Museum. My Republican father was outraged at this shabby treatment of these men. I was never certain whether he was offended more because they were singers or veterans, but it was a rare event for him to be so publicly vocal about any kind of public policy issue. I was very proud of him. In 1964, nearly 20 years after the end of World War II, a coalition of Northern Democrats and virtually all Republicans in Congress passed civil rights legislation which finally outlawed the practice of denying food and lodging to people of color. During the last 5 years of the chorus's tours, its members' service to their country was finally rewarded by access to accommodations in hotels significantly more luxurious than the sorry excuse for lodging at the Paddock and Burwood hotels in Beatrice, Nebraska.
Thanks, Michael. That was very interesting. Quickly getting back to the discussion of the military members that were African-American military units, probably a lot of you, hopefully a lot of you will recognize what we might be looking at there. That's the Tuskegee Airmen. The Tuskegee Airmen were officially the 332nd Pursuit Group who flew P-51s, which were the Ferraris of their day, over and engaged a number of missions, including operations over Sicily and later over the heart of Nazi-held Europe. They amassed an impressive flying record, flying 15,500 sorties and completing nearly 1,600 missions. During 200 missions in which they escorted bombers deep into Germany's Rhineland, not one of the bombers was lost, which was quite an incredible record. A major motion picture was made about them a few years ago, although I didn't think it nearly did them much. It didn't do a very good job of depicting their real story, unfortunately. Another primarily African-American unit who fought with distinction was the 761st Tank Battalion, unofficially known, as the Black Panthers. Their most famous member was Jackie Robinson, that Jackie Robinson, the first African-American to play Major League Baseball in the modern era. The 761st served with Patton's Third Army, although unsurprisingly for the day, Patton expressed doubts about using black men in combat. The unit first saw combat in November 1944 and served in France, Belgium, Germany, and Austria, and eventually met up with the Soviet Army as the two sides closed in on the Third Reich. I wish I had a little bit more time to research that. I wonder what the Ukrainian soldiers in the Soviet Army thought of meeting black Americans in Austria. What are the chances? The Medal of Honor was awarded to Staff Sergeant Reuben Rivers, who was part of the 761st Tank Battalion, although not until 1997, as it was unwritten policy, that the military did not award any black servicemen the Medal of Honor during the war. By the way, what they would do is they just lose the paperwork. It was very simple. Sergeant Rubens was killed while covering the withdrawal of other tanks while seriously wounded. Eventually the tank that he was in, which was his second or third tank of the day, was hit and he was killed. Again, their story is worthy of many hours of discussion. Individual accomplishments are many, but one of the most famous and certainly one of the first acts of heroism during World War II was that of Dory Miller. His real name was Doris Miller, but it was misspelled in the paper, so everybody knows him as Dory Miller. Miller was assigned to the battleship West Virginia, where he was a mess attendant, which was mostly what African-Americans did for the Navy. They were attendants. This was one of the few ratings then open to African-Americans. He was aboard the West Virginia when it was hit by 9 torpedoes while moored in Pearl Harbor, subsequently hit by quite a few more torpedoes and bombs. Miller was cited for bravery when he loaded and manned a 50-caliber anti-aircraft gun that he had no idea how to operate. He was also cited for assisting with moving his wounded captain while under constant bombing and strafing. He was awarded the Navy Cross, the third highest award for gallantry during combat. And then he was the subject of a 1943 Navy recruiting poster. Sadly, he was killed while serving as a petty officer third class against the Liscombe Bay, which was a little Jeep carrier, I think, when it was struck by a torpedo during the Battle of Macon Island. So this was one of the few posters that showed an African-American on it for any of the services. Well, that's the discussion, or that's probably the beginning of the discussion, I hope. There's so much more to all of what we talked about today. Again, if anybody wants to engage in more discussions and more research, it would be a thrill. I hope that you've learned something. I hope that you were aghast at some of our actions from 70 years ago. I knew a little bit about this 15 years ago, but after I started really researching it, it's become more and more of an interest to me. So that's it. And I don't know if we have any time for... Okay, 2 minutes. All right, 2 minutes.
Jim Chanteau. I had a chance about 15 years ago to visit the Smithsonian Institute. This was the Natural History Museum. And they had a special exhibit on the role of Japanese Americans in the Pacific. And they said up until about 1990, that had been a classified information. Nobody was allowed to know. that people were taken out of those internment camps. They had volunteered, and they were used as interpreters and interrogators in the South Pacific. But it was kept from American citizens that we had any Japanese Americans fighting on our side against the Imperial Japanese. And so this was a special exhibit, and there were apparently hundreds who did this, and many of them lost their lives. They were crawling into caves to try and talk Japanese soldiers out, and died as a result of going in there. But none of this was ever announced. They were given no benefits. Their families were given nothing because officially they never served.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. I didn't include that. It was another one of the thousands of aspects. They were called the Nisei, I believe is the right word. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you probably don't know that we had several Tuskegee Airmen living in our midst until just a few years ago, both here in Manhattan and in Junction City. You'd expect it with Fort Riley, and I had an opportunity to meet and visit with several of them. Mr. Butler, who was a well-known African-American leader here in Manhattan, was one of them. You may have known him, and we had the opportunity to acquire their personal memorabilia and museum pieces, but somewhere the ball was dropped along the way, and I think they've probably all died in the meantime.
Hi. Thank you. That was a great talk. The thing that comes to my mind is that whether we consider ourselves to be racist or non-racist, and whether we judge others who were racist, is that basically we're all human beings, and the human mind has a tendency toward judgment, and especially when we are afraid, and judgment and rationalization and fear. And so what I was thinking throughout this whole program was racism basically is an inevitable result of a human mind in some human beings. In other human beings who may not be racist, there may be some other result from fear, rationalization, and judgment. But we all fear, we all rationalize, and we all judge.
You had spoken about how the Japanese were a little close, but sorry. You talked about the propaganda portraying Japanese as inferior and then later superior as like superhumans, but how do you think that influenced the decision to use nuclear weapons to end that war?
That's a perfect question, and it made it easier, is the answer to that. In my interpretation of what I've read, absolutely, because they were still inhuman at that point. There are the arguments that it saved many lives, and undoubtedly it saved many American and Japanese civilians, military and civilian, and Japanese civilians. They were given instruction how to fight the Americans when we landed on shore, and of course we were very close to doing that. But yeah, it made it, I'm just going to say something that's not really worthy of, it's a longer discussion, but it made it easier, I think, is the answer, the very, very short answer. So yeah, that's a good question.
We'll over here, let's see, we're
Thank you, everyone. Please go in peace and justice.